Welcome to Business and Oil. Articles from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Becky. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Sunday, November 3rd, 2019, The Oil Report. Hearst Energy Awards. Lifetime Achievement. Midland Basin Forge Scott Sheffield's Career Path. Scott Sheffield has come full circle in an oil field career that began in the Midland Basin and has ended where it started, the Midland Basin. In the interim, Sheffield took a small oil and gas company known as Parker and Parsley Petroleum, where he was the fifth employee, and oversaw its transformation into Pioneer Natural Resources, now the state's second largest oil producer. Sheffield, recipient of the Hearst Energy Award for Lifetime Achievement, reflected on his achievements in an email to the Reporter-Telegram. Question, what drew you to your career in the oil industry? Has it been all you hoped? Answer, my father was a petroleum engineer and worked for ARCO. We lived in several countries growing up, such as Tehran, Iran, Caracas, Venezuela, and Jakarta, Indonesia. Initially, I rebelled against my father's wishes and attended the University of Texas at Austin as a pre-law student, but I switched to petroleum engineering after working 2 summers in the oil fields. I could not have hoped for a better career. By making strategic business decisions over a 10-year period and focusing on the Midland Basin, I was able to take a small Permian company and turn it to one of the largest independents in the world. My home is where I started. The Midland Basin is where I spent those 2 summers working in the oil fields, which ultimately changed my entire career path. Question, looking back over your career, what is your proudest achievement? Answer, with the help of 2,000 great employees, we turned the Permian Basin into one of the largest oil fields in the world. Pioneer has led the activity with over 1,500 horizontal wells drilled and producing over 400,000 barrels of oil equivalent. I'm also proud that Pioneer was one of the leaders in lifting the oil export ban that allows us to send Permian oil all over the world. Our ability to export has helped countries that do not want to be dependent on Russian and Middle Eastern oil. Question. You oversee a very influential and large oil and gas producing company. What is your management style? Answer. Today, Pioneer is the fourth largest independent in the U.S. with over 2,000 employees. My style is to get to know everyone in the company, listen to them, and treat them with the utmost respect. Question. What are your thoughts on the future of the Permian Basin, of fossil fuels, and how fossil fuels and renewables can coexist? Answer. Over the last 5 years, the Permian Basin has been the fastest-growing oil basin in the world, reaching 4.4 million barrels of oil per day and 15 billion cubic feet per day of natural gas. It is projected by most estimates to reach 8 million barrels a day and 30 billion cubic feet a day of natural gas over the next 10 years. Most people do not understand that we have the second largest gas field in the United States, behind the Marcellus in the northeastern U.S. Over the next 50 years, the basin will supply the U.S. and the world with its products. There are over 100,000 drilling locations left to be drilled in the Permian Basin, and most of them are on private lands. Companies have been drilling in the Midland Basin since 1946 and will continue drilling here past 2050. There will be new technology, such as enhanced oil recovery techniques, that could take the basin well past 2050 towards 2100. We may all be driving electric cars by that year, but the world will still need 75 million barrels per day. Oil from the Permian Basin has one of the lowest break-even prices in the world and will be around for decades to come. Hearst Energy Awards. Industry Advocacy. Industry Advocate appreciates its big heart. Tommy Taylor's roots in the Permian Basin run deep, having been raised in Hobbs, New Mexico, and Andrews. His ties to the region's oil and gas industry run deep, too. My dad was a petroleum engineer with Amoco. He oversaw the Midland Farms unit for Amoco, which is on Fasken property, said Taylor, director of oil and gas development for Fasken Oil and Ranch Limited. My two brothers are engineers, and my sister is a teacher, but she's married to an engineer, so it runs in the family. Those ties gave Taylor, recipient of the Hearst Energy Award for Industry Advocacy, a deep appreciation for the industry. My advocacy for the oil and gas industry of the Permian Basin goes beyond my appreciation for what this business has provided for me, my family, and our community. I'm also an advocate so that others may recognize that the Permian Basin not only delivers an abundant and dependable supply of oil and natural gas to the world, but also creates countless jobs, is innovative, and philanthropic, he said. Just look at the industry's response to Hurricane Harvey 2 years ago, he said. Look at what the oil and gas industry did. People sent supplies, water, people who gave their time. The industry has a big heart. I've always been proud of that. This is a very giving, very caring industry. Taylor is an advocate for the community, speaking out, for example, against plans to build high-level nuclear storage facilities around Andrews and Carlsbad, New Mexico. He also advocates for continued operational excellence in the industry. I sit on the board of Southwest Petroleum's Short Course, a project between the industry and Texas Tech's Engineering School, where we present papers on artificial lift and stimulation techniques, said Taylor. He said the Short Course also offers pre-conference schools on topics from pumping to artificial lift. It's a good source of training for young engineers, he said. Our industry is constantly evolving and looking for ways to improve our processes, to be more efficient, and to be better stewards of our resources. I've had the privilege to see us make great strides, such as those in the areas of water recycling, worker safety, and fugitive gas emission reductions, Taylor said. The energy production from this region also contributes to the economic security of Texas, New Mexico, and the United States of America. Our industry is producing the resources which have made the Permian Basin the epicenter for America's energy supply. We have the innovation, technology, and skilled workforce to keep our nation independent, strong, and secure into the future. That makes me proud to be an advocate for our industry and for this unique place we call the Permian Basin. Hearst Energy Awards, Technology. Well shock technology helps make legacy wells more productive. Everyone's always looking for a better way, save money, and increase opportunity to make money, said Jamie Mitchell, Vice President, Pumping Services at Bosque Systems. If you're not doing that for your customers, you're not doing business right, he said. The company's latest technology, designed to re-stimulate legacy wells and make them profitable again, known as Well Shock, has earned the company the Hearst Energy Award for Technology. Its development came out of customers pulling us in that direction, said Clain LaCrosse, Bosque founder, president, and chief executive officer. He said the company's foundation in the Permian Basin is how we help our customers reuse water. Mitchell said research began with saltwater disposal wells. We looked for ways to enhance flooding and enhance oil recovery on the backside, he said. What they found with Well Shock was that it not only re-stimulates legacy oil well production, but decreases pressure and increases injectivity in injection wells and impaired saltwater disposal wells through a combination of Bosque DIO, NIX technology, pressure pumping, and traditional acidization. The mixture of technology is most effective, he said, noting that one customer used the technology on 600 wells. LaCrosse said that success is showing up in increased production for customers. We had wells producing 1,000 barrels a day, then went down to 200 barrels a day. After Well Shock, production went back up to 900 barrels a day, he said. Mitchell said some production increases are still in place 9 months after the Well Shock technology was used. But he said the success depends on the specifics of the formation. You can't go back in and create something that's not there, he said. I had one customer tell me, if you can save me just 2 months of what I would have spent on remediation, you've won.
Hello, this is Paul reading from the front page of the Odessa American for Tuesday, November 5th, 2019. Energy areas hardest hit by fatalities. TxDOT starts Drive Smart campaign. With its new campaign, TxDOT is urging drivers in high-traffic oil and gas production areas to give trucks plenty of space, avoid distractions, drive a safe speed, and always buckle up. In 2018, 49,410 traffic crashes in the 61-county Permian Basin region resulted in 485 fatalities and 1,321 serious injuries. The number of traffic crashes in the Permian Basin region in 2018 increased 13% from that seen in 2017, and the number of fatalities increased 20% from 2017. Failure to control speed and driver inattention were the top contributing factors in these crashes. TxDOT's Be Safe, Drive Smart campaign urges motorists to use caution, as speeding is the leading factor in these crashes. A news release from TxDOT details that Texas continues to lead the nation in oil and gas production, creating jobs and prosperity statewide. But communities in the state's main energy production areas have also seen a rise in deaths on the road, accounting for close to half of all traffic fatalities in Texas. In 2018, 1,673 people died, and more than 6,000 were seriously injured in crashes in the Barnett Shale, Eagle Ford Shale, Granite Wash, Haynesville, Bossier Shale, and Permian Basin, where oil and gas exploration is underway. Traffic deaths in these areas are up by 4% compared to 2017. Crash reports point to failure to control speed as the most often cited factor in traffic crashes, followed by driver inattention due to actions such as looking at a cell phone. Driving conditions have changed dramatically in many parts of Texas, said Texas Department of Transportation Executive Director James Bass. A big increase in the number of heavy trucks and traffic on state and county roads adds to the complexity of driving, something we always need to give our full attention to, while also obeying traffic laws. That's why we are urging every motorist to drive smart and take simple precautions to prevent crashes. In the coming weeks, drivers can expect to see a variety of common sense safety reminders as TxDOT kicks off its annual Be Safe, Drive Smart campaign in the state's energy-producing regions. The campaign reminds drivers to always buckle up, drivers and all passengers, day and night. Drive a safe speed that takes into account the amount of traffic, road conditions, and weather. Focus 100% on driving and put your phone away. No talking or texting when you're behind the wheel. Give large trucks plenty of space, be patient, and pass only when it's safe and legal to do so. Obey stop signs and traffic signals. Never drive under the influence of alcohol or other drugs. TxDOT will be taking its safety messages to community events this month in the Permian Basin and Eagle Ford Shale. Drivers can test their street smarts at an interactive exhibit outfitted with games, quizzes, and video displays that remind motorists how to safely navigate the challenges of driving in high-traffic oil and gas production areas.
Hi, friends. This is Bailey with RLWT, and sometimes the newspaper sections run a bit short, so we have volunteers bring in feel-good stories that they enjoy reading. So enjoy a couple of these stories. Have a great day.
Hello, this is Zach, and I'm reading Three Wishes. A kind-hearted fifth grader is delivering smiles to the elderly by granting three wishes to everyone she meets. Ruby K. Chissy has spent a lot of her time visiting multiple long-term nursing care centers with her mother, Amanda Chissy, who is a nurse practitioner that provides heads-on care to residents. In doing so, Ruby Kate has fulfilled the request of residents in and around Harrison, Arkansas, such as buying snacks, gifts, and helping with pet care, and has raised over $60,000 along the way. She took something that we all know happens, the lonely plight of the impoverished institutionalized elderly, and she did something, Chessie told Good Morning America about Ruby Kate. She thought outside the box, and she used her giant heart powerfully to get it done. Elderly people living in nursing homes throughout the United States receive room and board and medical care through Medicaid, Chessie explained. These patients only receive $40 cash each month for anything extra. Ruby Kate Chessie, 11, grants small wishes of nursing home residents like buying them snacks and arranging so their pets can visit them at the facility which they live at. Ruby Kate's idea was born after she met a resident named Pearl, who was struggling to house and keep her dog. Chessie said Ruby Kate dipped into her piggy bank to cover the $12 cost of a pet sitter bringing her dog to the facility. Ruby Kate Chessie, 11, spends a lot of her time visiting nursing homes with her mother, Amanda Chessie, who is a nurse practitioner. Soon Ruby Kate was asking other residents, "If you had three wishes, what would they be?" She wrote their answers down in a journal, and her mom helped her set up a GoFundMe account to fund all the wishes. One woman requested fresh strawberries because she hadn't had any in nearly a decade. Many asked for snacks, gifts for their grandchildren, good books to read, and recently, Ruby Kate delivered McDonald's Happy Meals and desserts from a bakery to 50 residents. Ruby Kate and her mom were also approved to adopt a facility cat. "The residents cried when we told them Monday," Chessie said. "We are buying music programs. We are directly impacting lives every single day with one goal, to bring them joy." Ruby Kate created a Facebook page for her new project titled Three Wishes for Ruby's Residents. She also has an Amazon Smile list to fulfill the wishes of her friends from the nursing homes. Ruby Kate Chessie, 11, grants wishes of nursing home residents at 5 long-term care centers in 3 counties in and around Harrison, Arkansas. Last week, Ruby Kate was named GoFundMe Kid Hero of the Month due to her efforts helping nursing home residents. The mother-daughter pair plan to take the project to a national level next. "This is her hobby. This is where and how she has developed her own self-esteem and self-worth," Chessie said of her daughter. "Ruby rises by lifting others. It's been food for her soul and mind, too. Often we have said, the two of us have gotten more out of this project spiritually than the patients. They moved us."
The Dog That Came Back from the Dead by Eric Wagenknecht with Tess Stokes. On a run in the Rocky Mountains, the author's dog, Merle, fell 800 feet, injured beyond hope. But he wasn't done yet. We charge up the final ascent of the 13,041-foot Grand Traverse Peak, about 7 miles east of Vail, Colorado. My new running partner, Merle, a 1-year-old blue Australian Shepherd, seemed unfazed by the previous 8 miles we covered. I also felt strong, energized by the clear Rocky Mountain air and endless blue sky. It was Father's Day 2017, and I was set to return home to my 4-year-old son, Axel, my 9-year-old daughter, Lily, and my wife, Susan, by noon. As I reached the summit, I heard a short yelp, but assumed Merle would be seconds behind me, as he had been all morning. I snapped a photo of the view for my family, called out to the dog, then tucked my phone in my pack and headed back down the trail. Merle was nowhere to be seen. "Merle! Merle!" I called. "Where are you?" I felt a tickle of panic in my throat as I threaded my way down the ridge, still seeing no signs of him. But he was athletic and young and invincible. He must be fine, I reasoned. Then, several hundred feet farther down, I saw his paw prints on a 5-foot-wide strip of snow at the top of a steep chute. I followed them cautiously until they disappeared entirely off the edge. About 800 feet below, the chute ended abruptly in a boulder field and a massive cliff. Below that, I could see a wide, empty, snow-covered basin. There was no sign of Merle in the rock field or the basin. I could still hear that last yelp in my mind, and now I realized what it had signaled. Merle was gone. Merle and I had started the day at 4 a.m. at our home in Eagle, Colorado. I'd stacked my running clothes next to the bed the night before and filled my pack with water bottles, trail food, and a can of sardines, my go-to for big days in the mountains. It would be my first long run in the Gore Range this summer and my first big adventure with Merle. We'd bought the 40-pound blue and brown-eyed Aussie Shepherd 6 months earlier from a breeder in Durango. Merle quickly proved himself to be a phenomenal running partner. He could easily bang out 15 miles. That morning, we drove 36 miles from our house to the Deluge Lake Trailhead in East Vail. I'd grown up in Illinois, but as a kid made frequent trips to Vail, where my late father had a house. I'd hiked this trail every year since I was 7. My dad, a mountaineer and ultra-runner, would take me and my younger sister up the 8 miles to Deluge Lake, training, he called it, for our annual summit of Mount of the Holy Cross, the peak where I would spread his ashes in 2002. I hadn't thought twice about taking Merle up Grand Traverse. In fact, I'd expected him to beat me to the summit, which is why, even as I stood above the deep chute, I still thought, it's going to be okay. I knew this summit was the only spot on the trail where I would get cell service, so I called Susan, panicked. Merle fell. I don't know what happened, I told her. I'm going for him. It's okay. I'm okay. Then I saw something running in the basin below me. There he is. Oh, my God. I'm okay. I need to go. Okay, be safe, was all Susan had time to say before I hung up and ran down the ridge. Merle was sprinting downhill, away from me. I couldn't follow his nearly vertical route without technical climbing gear, so I needed to find a safer way down. After nearly an hour, I had made it to the basin, and I saw Merle standing on a large rock outcropping. Relief washed over me. Merle, come here, buddy. Good dog. I'm so sorry, I called. But he ran away. I didn't blame him. I'd taken him on a selfish pursuit to a selfish place. I'd pushed him too far. I followed Merle up the basin. Soon I was close enough to see that he looked oddly swollen. He was covered with lacerations, and his gait was hobbled and stiff. When I got within a few feet of him, he dived into a crack at the edge of a field of rocks. I grabbed his back legs for a moment, but he squirmed away, deep into a subterranean pocket within the boulders. I moved rocks and snow away from the crack's entrance until two backyard grill-sized boulders slid together, clamping my ring finger between them. I yanked out my hand and saw the nail was smashed and spurting blood. I threw on a glove from my pack to contain the flow, then kept digging. A few minutes later, I'd cleared enough snow to stick my head in the crack. I peered down into the darkness. I could hear the jingle of Merle's collar, but I couldn't see him. I yelled, alternating between angry and nearly hysterical and calm and coaxing. No response. I decided to give him space. Maybe he was okay, and my panic was freaking him out. I opened the can of sardines and left them as a lure at the mouth of the cave while I waited. I went to the scene of the fall. Above, I saw the path Merle had taken. He'd slid some 700 feet down the upper snowfield, fallen off a 40-foot cliff, then rolled down another 100-foot cliff to the lower snowfield where I now stood. How did he walk away from this, I thought. I returned to the crack, leaned in, and called his name again. Inside, it smelled wet. After a decade of archery hunting, I knew the scent. It smelled like death. I spent another hour crouched outside the cave until the jingle of the collar and Merle's deep breathing stopped. It was late afternoon, and I worried about losing daylight. I was on the wrong side of a big mountain, many miles from home, and not prepared to spend the night outside. I packed up, traversed the basin, descended a slushy snowfield, then found my way to the base of the chute I'd come down. I climbed the melting snowpack as quickly as I could, reusing my kicked steps from the descent. When I got reception, I phoned Susan. "I'm okay, Suze, but I'm walking down alone."
"Is he dead?"
"Yeah." Then I ran away, back down the trail. I didn't know that Lily and Axel had heard me through our car's Bluetooth system. After I hung up, they burst into tears. I've always owned dogs. They accompanied me into the mountains where, bounding off leash, they seemed protected by an invincible athleticism. Merle was bred for the trail. I had assumed the rugged Aussie would take to the high alpine trail intuitively. But the reality is that almost no one thinks about training their dogs for the mountains. In potentially deadly terrain, it's critical that humans help dogs understand their limits, says Amber Kwan, who runs Summit Dog Training in Fort Collins, Colorado. She helps owners and dogs prepare for outdoor adventures through relationship building and body conditioning classes. Dogs can't talk to us, but they have other ways of communicating that we need to pay attention to. It's up to us to learn their idiosyncrasies. Of course, it's difficult to tune into a dog's subtle behavior changes when you're listening to a podcast or chatting with your climbing partner. It's as simple as putting your phone down and being present in the moment, Kwan says. That communication leads to trust, which is the other part of taking a dog into the mountains. You have to trust your dog to make good decisions by giving her a safe amount of freedom and not always interrupting her natural behaviors, Kwan says. We want owners to help their dogs, but not micromanage them. The bottom line, she notes, is if a trip will be more stressful with your dog, leave him or her at home. I knew Susan questioned whether I'd done enough to keep Merle safe. My possible carelessness gnawed at me, too, so I called our longtime vet and friend, Charlie Manier, owner of Vale Valley Animal Hospital, to try to get some closure. He assured me I had done everything I could to save Merle. He crawled into that cave to secure shelter, which is typical for a dog in distress who is on the verge of dying. They hide and hunker down, he said. 3 weeks later, on July 8th, a real estate agent named Dana Dennis Gumber was preparing a listing in East Vale, less than a mile from the Deluge Lake Trailhood, where Merle and my journey had started off. She noticed a ragged-looking dog near the property's deck and assumed he belonged to the landscapers working on the complex. But when she returned to the house 2 hours later, the crew had left and the dog was curled by the front door. Gumber had noticed him limping earlier, and now she saw that he was filthy, weak, and skeletally thin. She ushered the dog into her car, then took him to her Eagle Vale home for food and water. Miraculously, Gumber found that the dog still had a collar. That afternoon, she left a voicemail on my cell. "I have Merle. Please call me." I'd left town a few days earlier for a work trip to Austria. I got the call and FaceTimed Susan back home immediately, where it wasn't yet dawn. Neither of us knew what the message meant. Susan assumed it was a sick prank, but she agreed to call the woman back that morning. A few hours later, we had an answer. Merle was alive, Susan said. "I'm getting him this afternoon." When she got to Gumber's house, she collapsed to the floor as soon as she saw Merle, gently stroking his battered body. He seemed to recognize her, though his wandering eyes made her think he'd suffered some brain damage. Susan drove him to the Vale Valley Animal Hospital, where emergency veterinarian Rebecca Hall found that Merle had 2 detached retinas, a punctured lung, facial lacerations, and sores on his hind legs. He had lost about 12 pounds, almost a third of his weight. His stool showed that he'd survived on pine needles and berries. He was tattered, but, remarkably, he didn't need stitches and none of his bones were broken. Dr. Hall was amazed that Merle had walked away from falling so far. He had hunkered down in a cave, likely gone into a coma, then woken up and seriously injured, covered 20 miles in 20 days to return home. You don't hear a lot of stories about dogs surviving in the wilderness, Quan says, but herding breeds are driven and tough. His return was most likely testament to his positive association with home. These dogs are incredibly bonded to their owners. Quan says Merle probably followed human smells on the trail to get back to civilization. We can't wrap our brains around how easy it is for a dog to follow a scent or hear traffic miles away, she says. Plus, after a week in the wilderness, Merle's senses had likely sharpened. I guess it was this combination plus intuition and some luck that got him home, she says. Over the next week, while I was still away, Merle recovered beautifully. His wandering eyes straightened, he gained weight, and his gait returned to normal. Axel and Lily, who now fully believe in miracles, spent every moment with their best friend. When I got home just after midnight, one day later that month, I walked through the front door, anxious to see Merle. Would he run from me again? I entered our living room, then kneeled down and called him to me. He gave a quick bark before lowering his ears, tucking in his tail, and wiggling onto my lap. He clawed my chest like he wanted to climb on top of my shoulders and kissed my face.
Three stories of truly inspiring blind people. We all face hardship, but for many, the thought of losing our sight is a horrifying prospect. Despite facing immense difficulties as a result of vision loss, there are some truly amazing people in the world who have overcome their disability to achieve amazing things. In this article, we're highlighting three of the most inspiring blind people. Daniel Kish, Daniel Kish Success Magazine. Daniel was born with retinoblastoma, an aggressive form of cancer that attacks the retinas, leading to vision loss. By the time he was 13 months old, Daniel had both of his eyes removed in a life-saving operation. Although this is not a highly unusual scenario, what sets Daniel apart from other blind people is his ability to see the world around him using a technique called echolocation. This technique involves generating a sound, typically a click of the tongue, then listening to the echoes of sound that bounced off the surrounding objects, allowing Daniel to paint a picture of the world around him. Although Daniel was not the first person to use this technique, he has now become an expert in human echolocation and has begun training other blind people to use this technique through his nonprofit charity, World Access for the Blind. As of 2015, Kish's leadership had already enabled the charity to introduce more than 500 students to echolocation. From the age of 18, Kish opted out of relying on a caregiver, instead practicing complete independence, to the point that he's even rejected the use of his cane, choosing to rely solely upon his prophetic click in echolocation. For this reason, he is a divisive figure in the blind community. Many have great respect for him, but some regard him with disdain for using behavior that could be deemed as abnormal. Despite his polarizing nature, Daniel Kish is freeing many blind people from the constraints society places upon blind people. His hopes for the future lie in a handheld sonic device that can enable every blind person to use echolocation and lead a fuller life. Eric Vi Hainmeyer. Adversity alone has the unique power to inspire exceptional clarity, purge any vestiges of lethargy, refocus your priorities, hone your character, and unleash your most potent forces. Eric Vi Hainmeyer, The Adversity Advantage, Turning Every Struggles into Everyday Greatness. Eric Vi Hainmeyer was born with retinoschisis, a condition in which the retina separates into two layers, resulting in poor vision. He completely lost his sight at age 13, but this did little to quell his ambition. Eric has spent his whole life overcoming seemingly impossible challenges to become one of the most accomplished adventurers in the world. In 2001, he was crowned the first and only blind man to reach the summit of Mount Everest. In 2008, he climbed the seven summits, which involved climbing the highest mountain on each of the seven continents, a feat which only 118 others have achieved. Eric has also made other remarkable ascents, including climbing the infamous nose of El Capitan in Yosemite, USA, and a 2,700-foot vertical ice face in Nepal, named Lusar. Along with a taste for adventure, Eric is heavily involved in various charities for the visually impaired and co-founded No Barriers USA, which aims to aid people with various disabilities to live full and rewarding lives. Eric has also written two books, and his unique life story was made into an award-winning feature film called Farther Than the Eye Can See. The film has raised more than $600,000 for charitable organizations around the world and received critical acclaim. More recently, Eric's speaking career has taken him across the globe, highlighting that you don't have to have perfect sight to have a vision. Marla Runyon. Marla Runyon Runner's World. At the age of 9, Marla developed Stargust, a disease that left her legally blind but still with her peripheral vision. While studying at San Diego State University, she began competing in several athletic sports, including the heptathlon, high jump, and shot put. In 1999, at the Pan American Games, Runyon submitted herself as a world-class runner by winning the 1500-meter race. Just a year later, she became the first legally blind athlete to compete in the Olympics, achieving the highest finish by an American woman in the 1,500-meter event. And the following year, Marla was crowned the USA 5K Outdoor Champion, a feat which she repeated the following year. Marla is believed to be one of the most versatile and well-rounded athletes ever to compete and win at national and world-class levels. She held records in the 20 kilometers, 500 meters, female marathon, and heptathlon. Not only is she an exceptional Olympian, Marla is dedicated to supporting other blind people and has been an ambassador for the Perkins School for the Blind since 2001. As you can see from these truly inspiring people, turning blind or being born without sight does not mean a lesser life. Whether this involves scaling the world's tallest peaks or pioneering charities to enrich and empower other visually impaired people, these three inspirational people have done it all.
Charity, good deeds. In life, they were humble secretaries, teachers, and janitors. When they died, they were richer than anyone knew, and they gave millions to charity. By Juliana LaBianca. Whenever Jane Lockshin went out to lunch with her elderly aunt, Sylvia, she made a point to pick up the tab. After all, Sylvia Bloom was a modest secretary, a widow of more than a decade who lived in a one-bedroom Brooklyn apartment and took the subway everywhere, including to her job at a Manhattan law firm. She worked there, full-time, until she was 96. Simply put, Lockshin didn't want Aunt Sylvia to blow her budget on lunch. So, when Bloom died in 2016, at 97, it was something of a shock to discover that she'd left behind a multi-million-dollar estate. Almost as shocking, she had chosen to give $8.2 million to charity. $6 million went to educational programs at the Henry Street Settlement, a social services organization in New York City. An additional $2 million went to scholarship funds, including at Bloom's alma mater, Hunter College. She had millions, said Lockshin, and no one suspected it. Bloom's bequest to the settlement, the largest in its 126-year history, will help fund a program for disadvantaged students. The gift has been transformative, not just because of the good we'll be able to do with it, says David Garza, the agency's executive director, but because of the selflessness and the humility behind it. Sylvia Bloom's story is indeed extraordinary. But it's not as uncommon as you might think. Working-class benefactors, secretaries, teachers, janitors, and more make headlines with awe-inspiring regularity. In 2015, a retired grocer in Milwaukee left $13 million to a local Catholic high school. The year before, a former J.C. Penney janitor from Vermont left a nearly $5 million bequest to a local hospital. Their stories are as rich and as full as their hidden bank accounts. In a world that is in many ways survival of the fittest, They're certainly a special class of people, says Garza. These unassuming philanthropists share some qualities. The most obvious is that they often have no children. That's one reason many of them were able to save so much of their humble paychecks. It also means they had no direct natural heirs. People who are single are thinking about what good they can do with their money and what legacy they want to leave, says Stacy Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Often that legacy touches on helping the children they never had. As a kid in Milwaukee, Leonard Gagowski took the 6:30 bus every morning to get to St. Francis Minor Seminary, a Catholic high school that later became St. Thomas More High School. After a stint in the Navy, Gagowski went on to become a butcher and a grocer. He never married, and he never forgot St. Thomas More. Gagowski visited regularly and sometimes would eat lunch with the students in the cafeteria. One time he stood up and started singing the school cheer. His kids, as Gagowski called them, grinned and joined him. On his 90th birthday in 2015, administrators arranged a surprise assembly for him. The kids sang Happy Birthday, and Gagowski led them in prayer. 3 months later came the bombshell. Leonard Gagowski had passed away, and he'd left behind a $13 million scholarship fund for St. Thomas More. I nearly fell off my chair, Mary McIntosh, the school's president, told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gagowski may have been humble, but he led a very full life. He was an avid ballroom dancer. He had a dance floor in the basement of his modest suburban home. He also loved pigeon racing. He had a coop in his yard and kept meticulous records on each of his birds. He told me he loved being around God's creatures and caring for them, says his friend Jeff Corple. But the school was his passion. Larry Haskin, Gagowski's friend and the lawyer who helped him set up the Leonard Gagowski Catholic Education Foundation, says there was no doubt that Gagowski had saved his money with the intent of donating as much as he could to the students of St. Thomas More. He wanted to have the greatest impact possible on future generations, Haskin says. He felt he owed his long life to God, his Catholic education, and his deep faith, and he wanted to pass it on, Corporal adds. Gagowski had a lot in common with Margaret Southern, a special needs teacher from Greenville, South Carolina, who died in 2012 at age 94. Southern loved children and animals. Before she allowed Mike Shane, vice president of wealth management at UBS, to handle her investments, she made him promise to take in her dachshund, Molly, if anything happened to her. I know you'll take care of her, she told him. In fact, Southern outlived Molly by several years and had her buried in her yard. But she continued to worry about animals, especially those that were homeless. When she died, she left half her $8.4 million estate to the Greenville Humane Society, even though she'd never had any direct contact with the organization, and the other half to the Community Foundation of Greenville, which distributed the money to organizations that benefit early childhood education and special education for children. She also left money to various friends and family. It's a wonderful surprise to wake up and find a very unassuming woman who cares greatly for our community and its children, said Susan Shee, Ph.D., founder and chair emerita of the Institute for Child Success, a recipient of $25,000. Southern's wealth also came as a shock to most who knew her. She lived in a modest townhouse and got around Greenville in a gray 1980s model Cadillac. Her money came from a few shares of stock left to her by her husband, who had died in 1983. She added to that through the 80s, if only to feather a nest for others to use. What's exceptional is she didn't spend it on herself, and she was able to accumulate a lot of money that she wanted to direct to her dearest charities, Bob Morris, president of the Community Foundation, told the Greenville News. I haven't met a lot of people like that. Did their generous natures help Southern and these other extraordinary givers live so long? It's possible. Studies have found that people who are charitable, whether it's via volunteering or donating money, tend to have lower blood pressure, less stress, and longer lives. One 2011 study even found that older volunteers had a lower risk of dying in a 4-year period than non-volunteers. They certainly understood the importance of planning for the future. Careful, conservative investing, putting money in the stock market and leaving it there to grow, has always been the ticket to a comfortable retirement, and that's how these working-class benefactors built their legacies. For instance, when Sylvia Bloom was a young legal secretary, part of her job was to keep track of her boss's stock purchases. She'd take note of which stocks the lawyers were buying and buy a few shares for herself. She invested in the market and didn't spend it, says Lockshin. She followed the rules. Ronald Reed was a blue-collar guy with blue-chip smarts, a gas station attendant and JCPenney janitor in Brattleboro, Vermont. He read the Wall Street Journal every day, following his investments in Ford, IBM, Procter & Gamble, and CV's Health. When he died in 2014, at age 92, he was worth $8 million. But while he had watched his money carefully, he rarely touched it. After one of his last meetings with his attorney, Laurie Rowell, she insisted on walking her frail client to his car. They proceeded up a steep hill, passing empty parking spots as they went. When they got to Reed's 2007 Toyota Yaris, Rowell realized why he had chosen that spot. There were no parking meters at the top of the hill. You would have thought he was penniless if you met him, she says. In fact, Reed didn't even want his lawyer to walk with him to the car because he thought she might charge him for the time. Reed's frugality was sometimes mistaken for actual poverty. One morning, the man ahead of him in line for coffee noticed Reed's tattered clothes and promptly paid for his drink. He got his coffee that day, and most others at Brattleboro Memorial Hospital, which serves some of the best Java in town. That coffee shop was beloved by a number of people, says Rowell. They took good care of him. When Reed died, hospital officials were surprised that he had left the bulk of his estate, nearly $5 million, to the hospital. Some of us knew he had some investments, his stepson, Philip Brown, told the Brattleboro Reformer, but obviously he had a whole lot more that we didn't know about. Not every working-class benefactor scrimped and saved. Kathleen McGowan, a teacher from Simsbury, Connecticut, had no idea she was rich until just before she died in 2011 at age 87. Not long before she passed away, she visited a small law firm for help managing her estate. When they asked how much she thought it was worth, McGowan guessed around $40,000. The real number? $6 million. McGowan's twin brother, Robert McGowan, had always managed their finances. They had lived together until he died in 2010. She never had a demand for that kind of money, her attorney, Louis George, told the Hartford Courant. Some would go on a shopping spree if they became millionaires overnight. McGowan turned to charity. Her will outlined $5 million to bequests to 15 organizations, along with gifts to relatives and neighbors. She left close to $500,000 each to her alma mater, the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford, the McLean Nursing Home where she spent her final days, and the Simsbury Public Schools, where she had taught first grade for 35 years. All of us remember her very much as a schoolteacher who always had a twinkle in her eye, Dean Morris, the former fundraising director at McLean told the Hartford Courant. She loved engaging in conversation with all sorts of different people, and everyone loved talking to her. A schoolteacher, that's how she lived in our hearts.
A Wingman for Life by Jen McCaffrey. As an Air Force pilot in Vietnam, Jim McGee flew 471 combat missions and earned 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses. When he served as the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe from 2007 to 2009, he defied the murderous regime of then-President Robert Mugabe, who threatened him with expulsion. But after Jim retired from the Foreign Service, he encountered a problem no amount of courage or diplomacy could solve. In 2017, he found himself exhausted during a trip to South Africa. When he came home to Sarasota, Florida, he went to see a nephrologist. "The reason I was fatigued," Jim says, "was that my kidneys were gone." Jim, 69, immediately started dialysis 3 days a week, but his long-term prognosis wasn't good. A person his age on dialysis usually lives only about 4 years. Transplants are a long-shot alternative. The National Kidney Foundation estimates that 13 people die every day while waiting for a donor with the right blood and tissue types. Jim's wife, Shirley McGee, was a match, and his 37-year-old nephew, a police detective in great shape, also stepped up. But their kidney functions weren't strong enough. 4 family friends offered but weren't a match. Desperate, Shirley had T-shirts made up that said, "I'm in need of a donor." Her husband would wear one whenever he went to downtown Sarasota. No luck. Jim was so discouraged that, in early 2018, he was even considering not attending a reunion of some Air Force buddies in Monterey, California. "I said, is this really worth going out to Monterey to sit in dialysis for 2 days? Jim recalls. And my wife said, "Yeah, come on. You really want to see your friends." And boy, am I glad I made that decision. At a bed and breakfast in California, Jim reunited with 6 fellow airmen, including one he hadn't seen in nearly 50 years, Doug Kaufman. The two had met when they both were learning Vietnamese in a 9-month immersion course at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey before they went overseas. Jim told Doug and his other comrades about his predicament. "I asked him what his blood type is, and he said, 'O positive,' says Doug, an author who lives in Eugene, Oregon. 'Well, that happens to be my blood type. I was immediately thinking, gosh, I might be able to help.'" Doug, then 70, knew from regular visits to his doctor that he was healthy and vigorous. He also felt a strong bond with his band of brothers, even though he hadn't seen some of them in decades. Their connection went beyond the battlefield in ways most soldiers never experience. After entering the Air Force in the 60s and serving for 3 years, Doug decided to register as a conscientious objector, an unusual decision by an active duty military person. He continued to serve while waiting for his case to be heard. In the meantime, a member of his unit wrote a letter supporting his petition to become a conscientious objector. "I've always appreciated that some of those fellows helped me during my time of need," says Doug, who won his case after a few months and was reassigned to non-combatant status in the United States. "So I felt like this was a time that I could pay that ahead and continue that bond into the future," he says. But could he? When Doug confided to Shirley that he wanted to donate a kidney, she thanked him, but said her guess was that doctors would tell Doug what they had told her. "You're too old." And I said, "All I know is that I've got 2 really good kidneys, so I'd like to give those a go," Doug recalls. He immediately had his doctor send his medical records to Georgetown University Medical Center, where Jim was being treated. Within a month of their Air Force reunion, Doug was cleared for major testing. He flew to Washington, D.C. in mid-August, where he underwent 5 days of MRIs, EKGs, CT scans, urinalysis, and more. Jim was grateful but didn't want to get his hopes up. "Until we heard those final results that yes, you are an absolute match. I didn't want to get too crazy," Jim says, "because the letdown is severe." The testing revealed not only that Doug's tissue type matched Jim's, but also that he had the kidneys of a 35-year-old. His secret? "I just lead a good, clean life," Doug says. "Just the usual stuff to stay healthy." When the doctors gave him the okay to donate, Doug immediately called Jim, then asked for the first surgery date available. Jim and Shirley put their dog in the car and drove up to Washington, D.C. On September 18, 2018, Doug and Jim sat side by side in hospital gowns on adjoining beds. Doug went into surgery at 7:30 a.m. Jim followed at 9:30 a.m. By noon, they were both in the recovery room. The transplant was a success. "It's pretty miraculous to be able to take an organ out of one person's body, a living organ, put it in another person's body, and have it work," Doug says. "And there's nothing finer than knowing I've helped another person live a better life."
Voters approve state income tax ban, most other constitutional amendments. This was written by Alex Samuels of the Texas Tribune. Amendments to the state constitution that would make it harder to enact a state income tax would stabilize funding for state parks and would allow retired law enforcement animals to be adopted by their handlers, received widespread support from voters Tuesday. Supporters of one of the most contentious issues on the ballot, Proposition 4, proclaimed victory within hours of the polls closing, with about three-fourths of voters supporting the proposal in early voting returns. The proposition, authored by State Representative Jeff Leach, a Republican from Plano, and State Senator Pat Fallon, a Republican from Prosper, eliminates the possibility of Texas imposing an income tax unless the state changes its constitution again. The proposal drew ire from left-leaning groups, including the Center for Public Policy Priorities, which spent thousands to defeat it. On Election Day, the group ran digital ads in targeted areas of the state and sent out two mail pieces to tens of thousands of Texas households, according to a spokesman for the group. Governor Greg Abbott declared an early victory on the proposition in a statement on Tuesday evening. Quote, "Today's passage of Proposition 4 is a victory for taxpayers across the Lone Star State," he said. "I am grateful to Representative Jeff Leach for his bold leadership on this issue and for the overwhelming majority of Texans who voted to ensure that our great state will always be free of a state income tax. This ban on such a disastrous tax will keep our economy prosperous, protect taxpayers, and ensure that Texas remains the best state to live, work, and raise a family," end quote. The only item on the ballot that did not pass was Proposition 1, which would permit elected municipal court judges to serve multiple municipalities at the same time. As of Wednesday morning, it had received just over one-third of the vote. The other propositions were poised to pass easily. Proposition 5, which would stabilize funding for state parks, received overwhelming support. The proposition allows money accumulated from the existing tax on sporting goods to be used for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and the Texas Historical Commission. Current law allows the legislature to allocate that money however it sees fit. Proposition 10, which had the highest level of support, amends the state constitution to allow retired service animals, such as dogs or horses, to be adopted by their handlers or other qualified caretakers. These animals are currently classified as surplus property or salvage and can be auctioned, donated, or destroyed. Proposition 6, which allows for an increase of bonds allocated to the Cancer Prevention and Research Institute of Texas, received nearly two-thirds support, according to preliminary results from the Texas Secretary of State. Voters were also overwhelmingly in favor of Proposition 8, which would set aside $800 million from the state's Rainy Day Fund for flood mitigation efforts. The legislature approved the amendment after Hurricane Harvey's devastation along the Texas coast. The proposition netted about 3/4 of the vote as of Wednesday morning. Another Harvey-related item, Proposition 3, also passed easily. The ballot initiative allows the legislature to provide temporary tax breaks for people with property damaged in governor-declared disaster areas. The legislature approved the resolution unanimously earlier this year. Turnout in constitutional amendment elections is historically low. In 2013, only 1.1 million people voted. In 2011, only 690,000 Texans showed up of the 12.8 million who were registered to vote at the time to vote on 10 amendments. A majority of Texas voters must approve any changes to the Texas Constitution. Getting a proposed amendment on the ballot requires support from more than 2/3 of both chambers of the legislature. In addition to the constitutional amendments, Harris County voters had several other contentious elections on the ballot, including its mayor's race, city council elections, and a state House special election.